In his 70th birthday year, Plácido Domingo returns to the Royal Opera House to perform complete acts from three great Verdi operas with special significance for him as a singer and actor: Otello, Rigoletto, and Simon Boccanegra, intense characters driven to extreme actions. It's sure to be one of the operatic occasions of the year. So join me, Andrew McGregor, for the Plácido Domingo celebration at the Royal Opera House, Covent Garden, 40 years after his first appearance on that famous stage. Opera on Three, this evening from 6 on BBC Radio 3.
Well, this is BBC Radio 3. We're on 90 to 93 FM on digital radio and also online. It's a minute past 1 o'clock and time for the news, read by Vaughan Savage.
At least 7 people are now known to have died in a multiple pile-up on the M5 in Somerset last night. Police say they fear the number of dead will rise. The crash near Taunton, involving more than 30 cars and lorries, caused a huge fireball. More than 50 people were injured, some seriously. Emergency workers who were called to the scene described it as the worst accident they could remember. The Greek Prime Minister George Papandreou says talks with opposition parties on forming a coalition government will begin immediately. Following a meeting with the country's president, Mr. Papandreou said the main aim of the coalition would be to ratify the bailout package agreed by European leaders last week. Mr. Papandreou, who narrowly won a vote of confidence in Parliament last night, is yet to say whether he intends to lead the new government. A series of shootings and bombings in northeastern Nigeria has left more than 65 people dead and many others injured. A Red Cross spokesman said most of the dead were in the town of Damaturu, where the police headquarters, government offices and several churches came under attack. Many people are reported to have fled the town. The Shadow Home Secretary, Yvette Cooper, has called on the government to get a grip on border security after it was claimed that passport checks for non-EU nationals had been relaxed. The head of the UK Border Force, Brodie Clark, has been suspended following claims he told staff not to bother scanning biometric passports or checking fingerprints. Activists in Syria say there's been more bloodshed today as the authorities continue their attempts to suppress anti-government protests. Syrian tanks are reported to have killed at least 3 civilians in the city of Homs. The Archbishop of York, John Sentamu, has entered the row over big city salaries, warning that huge gaps in the earnings of the rich and poor are harming society. He says there must be a change in public attitudes towards excessive personal wealth. The weather, cloudy across eastern parts of England without breaks of light rain. It will be largely dry elsewhere. The BBC News and Weather at 1:03.
And that was Vaughan Savage. Well, at 2 o'clock today, there's another chance to hear last Monday's recital from Wigmore Hall in London. It's a programme of Baroque arias sung by Sarah Mingardo, with Benjamin Bale playing the harpsichord and Richard Sweeney the theorbo. And it includes works by Vivaldi, Marcello, Pergolesi and Handel. And that all starts at 2 o'clock. But now, as part of the BBC's month-long celebration of the symphony, we join Lucy Skeeping to traverse the worlds of music past in today's Early Music Show.
Spirited Music is by a composer called Georg Christoph Wagenseil. For just about his entire career, he was in Vienna, employed at the imperial court as composer and keyboard master to the Habsburg Empress Maria Theresa. He called the piece a symphony, but as you probably noticed, back then, the second half of the 18th century, symphonies had yet to become the sort of lengthy and deeply emotional works of, say, Brahms or Beethoven. These early symphonies were much lighter, something to have playing in the background while aristocrats drank tea, chatted or played cards. The main attraction in those days, what did make them sit up and listen, was the soloist, some virtuoso who would dazzle everyone with great feats of technique or vocal gymnastics. In fact, it was written at the time, the symphony's main purpose is to prepare the listener for an important piece of music. So how did we get from then to now? And at what point in history did the word symphony get coined at all? Well, in today's programme, we're going to explore the origins of the symphony. And for that, we need to go right back to the ancient world. As you might expect, it's a Greek word. Well, two actually. Syn, meaning together, and phon, meaning sounding. And it was the Romans who had the bright idea of putting the two words together to make the Latin word symphonia or symphonia. But for ages, it wasn't quite clear exactly what a symphony actually was. The illustrious churchman, St. Isidore of Seville, began the confusion by giving it several definitions in his great 7th century tome of etymologies. But they were at least all musical instruments of some sort, including a kind of two-headed drum. And I can't leave the scholarly St. Isidore without mentioning that he's recently been nominated by some blogging types, maybe even with Vatican approval, for the title of Patron Saint of the Internet. So at least we may have someone to pray to now when the computer blows a fuse. Anyway, a quick bit of time travel, and we're in the 12th century, where the word symphony now applies to an instrument that hasn't always had such a good press, namely the humble hurdy-gurdy, which you can hear droning along under this cheerful English melody. Eddie Bithou, Heaven Quen, one of very few surviving English tunes from the 1100s, performed there by Sequentia. The hurdy-gurdy, or symphony as it was called then, was basically an oblong box with strings inside which were stroked by a wheel that was turned by a handle on the outside. Sturdy and weatherproof and able to play both tune and drone at the same time, the great thing was you didn't have to worry about stopping for breath or changing the direction of the bow. You just kept turning the handle for as long as the dancing lasted, or until your fee ran out. So in earlier times, the word symphony, or symphonia, was applied to an instrument rather than a musical form as we use it today. And those instruments seem to have been more or less anything with strings, anything in fact that, like the hurdy-gurdy, could produce several sounds or lines of music simultaneously. By the early 17th century, we find the term applied to quite a range of keyboard instruments as well, including the virginals and the spinet that we hear first in this set. A Galliard by John Bull, performed by Gary Cooper on the virginals. And before that, Martha Gamunda played Giles Farnaby's The Old Spagnoletta on the spinet, one of the pieces from the anthology Terpsichore, published by Michael Pretorius, a composer himself, who frequently used the word symphony to describe just about any kind of keyboard. Instruments where lots of strings are stretched over a wooden frame are common to many folk cultures. I once even read about something called a dresser piano, where a set of strings from high to low pitches were simply stretched across an old kitchen dresser and hit with a hammer to make them vibrate. I'm not sure what it would have sounded like, but but no doubt the empty cupboards at the bottom would have acted as some kind of sound box, and in experienced hands it may well have sounded something like a spinet, although Gary Cooper probably wouldn't agree with me. But perhaps the most classic of these is the dulcimer, where the strings are stretched across a triangular-shaped box that can be put on your lap or on a table. It's a wonderful, slightly unearthly sound, which might explain why the word dulcimer crops up so often in the Bible. But don't be misled. The original Greek word in the Bible was symphonia, and when the translators of the King James Version came across it back in the early 17th century, they translated it as dulcimer. Not surprising, perhaps, as the dulcimer was an extremely popular instrument in those days. We now know, though, that what the Greeks probably meant was actually a type of bagpipe, which does, I suppose, put a rather different slant on the sort of music that's described in the Psalms. Maybe it wasn't quite as laid back and ethereal as we thought. Having said that, dulcimer-like instruments do certainly go back a long way and are still found in folk traditions all over the world, including Hungary, where it's known as a cymbalum, America, think Joni Mitchell, and China, where they call it the yankin. As for the word dulcimer itself, well, that comes from the Latin word dulce, meaning sweet. And here's how it would have sounded in all its sweetness back in the 17th century. One of the lovely old tunes published in Playford's English Dancing Master, The Devil Among the Tailors.
Thank you.
The Devil Among the Tailors, played on the Old English Dulcimer by Jim Couser. You're listening to The Early Music Show with me, Lucy Skeeping, and today I'm exploring the origins of the word symphony. Well, so far we've encountered a whole host of musical instruments that were known as symphonies, but what about the use of the word to describe a piece of music? The first appearance of a symphony in that sense is found in Renaissance Italy, in the magnificent wedding celebrations in 1589 of Fernando de Medici and the French Princess Christine of Lorraine. The tradition in Florence at that time was to perform short musical interludes, a song perhaps, or an instrumental piece, within, say, a feast or a tournament, or between the acts of a play where they would hopefully cover the noise of changing scenery. Gradually, though, these interludes, or intermedi, as they were called, began to take on a life of their own. They expanded enormously, developed their own scenery, action and dances, until they'd become more important than the play itself. Several leading composers collaborated on the six intermedi performed at the Medici wedding. Luca Marenzio, the foremost madrigal composer of the day, wrote the second and the third, while the musical director Cavalieri provided various arias and the grand finale. Three others wrote a song each, including the stage director Giovanni de Bardi, while most of the rest was provided by Cristofana Malvezzi, the maestro di cappella of Florence Cathedral, who also added several short instrumental pieces, which were called sinfonias. A Sinfonia by Malvezzi, part of the elaborate so-called Florentine Intermedi, whose publication in 1591 marked the first appearance in print of the word sinfonia. From this point, the term came to be used more and more frequently to describe all types of music, and many composers in the early 17th century wrote pieces that were called symphonies or sinfonias. They could be vocal or instrumental, or a mix of both. Sometimes they were little more than a prelude or a fanfare, like the sort of thing you get at the beginning of a Monteverdi opera, and the performers seemed to have had the option of leaving them out altogether if they felt like it. In the last years of the 16th century, the Venetian Giovanni Gabrielli took over the top job as organist of St Mark's Cathedral. He was also responsible for the music at nearby San Rocco, and it was there, in the summer of 1608, that his collection of motets was first performed. Sinfonia Sacrae was the title, or Sacred Symphonies. Many of them were seasonal pieces, heard on special feast days, and we'll hear part of a motet for Easter now. Surrexit Christus, which combines voices and the instruments so characteristic of the St Mark's sound. Two cornets, two violins and four sackbuts.
Christus.
So, pieces entitled sinfonias, symphonies or sinfonias were often placed at the beginning of a larger work as a prelude or, in the case of a stage work, as an early kind of overture. And some of the most famous of these are by Alessandro Scarlatti, who always began his operas with a sinfonia. You could say this was really the take-off point for the great 19th century epic concert hall symphonies that we know today. But as opera preludes, Scarlatti's 18th century versions were shorter, just three movements, fast, slow, fast. And he didn't really expect the audience to listen to them. They were more likely to be finding their seats, waving to their friends and chatting while the music was playing. Gradually, though, as the century wore on, these popular operatic symphonies were taken out of the theatre and performed in the concert hall as pieces in their own right. Here's Scarlatti's Sinfonia from his opera Griselda, which sets the scene for the first act, the landing of a ship on the island of Sicily. Scarlatti's Sinfonia that begins his opera Griselda, the Academy for Alte Musik Berlin, directed by René Jacob. Now we reach some major confusion. Around the beginning of the 18th century, we find pieces that we'd call sonatas or concertos, also given the name Sinfonia. And to illustrate this, we need to stay in Italy, this time in Bologna, to hear music by one of Corelli's contemporaries, a musician named Giuseppe Torelli. Torelli was also a virtuoso violinist, but he was evidently very keen on the sound of the trumpet, writing at least 34 pieces for the instrument entitled Symphonies. This may seem strange for a fiddler, but Torelli knew just how popular the trumpet was with audiences, where, particularly in the opera house, it often expressed the sort of warlike or patriotic sentiments that were very much in vogue at the time. He was also keen to catch the attention of the audience, and a loud instrument was just the thing to be heard over the shuffling, chatting, late arrivals and so on. Then, as the music progressed and people settled down, he could indulge in more refined counterpoint, developing new themes and bringing other instruments to the fore, like the violin, before returning to the triumphant style of a fanfare to finish. So here's one of Torelli's symphonies. For all the world, though, surely a trumpet concerto. Sandro Vezzari was the trumpet soloist with Ensemble Seicento-Novecento in Torelli's Sinfonia in G. Well, short though they were, with those three contrasting movements, you can see how gradually we're moving towards something that looks like the modern symphony. Over time, the concertos and choral works that have been called symphonies became fewer and fewer. And for the next development, we must look to the German lands, to a particular court and indeed a particular composer. Johann Stamitz was a musician of exceptional drive and talent. In the mid-18th century, at the age of just 25, he was taken on as a violinist in the electoral court at Mannheim, rising just a few years later to become musical director. He was now in charge of one of the most famous and brilliant orchestras in Europe, and he exploited their skills to the full with his groundbreaking symphonies, innovative orchestral pieces that would put Mannheim on the map and earn Stamitz a place in the history books. Taking his cue from some of the advances made by leading Italian composers, he now began to write more expansive works, leaving far behind the old Baroque traditions and seeing on the horizon the very beginnings of the Romantic style. He now looked for contrasts, drama and emotion. He added a fourth movement to his symphonies, often a minuet and trio. And most important of all, he asked his instrumentalists, virtuosos everyone, to crescendo and to diminuendo, an effect that, in earlier times, had simply been achieved by adding more players to the texture. The pastoral symphony we're going to hear now is one of Stamitz's last. These pastoral pieces were very popular with audiences, and although many of them were destined for church performance, the Feast of the Nativity and so on, a great many more were composed purely for secular occasions. Some include typical country references like drones or even yodeling themes. And here, in the final movement, Stamitz quotes an old Bohemian carol, a simple tune which would have been instantly recognisable to his listeners.
Thank you.
Symphonia Pastorale by Johann Stamitz, who developed the symphony at the court of Mannheim during the middle years of the 18th century. The musicians were the Northern Chamber Orchestra, conducted by Nicholas Ward. Well, for a programme that calls itself the Early Music Show, I guess our exploration of the origins of the symphony is nearly over. And so I'll leave you in the capable hands of one of the most prolific writers of symphonies, Joseph Haydn. Here's the third movement from his Symphony No. 18 in G.
the final movement of Haydn's 18th Symphony. It was played there by the Hanover Band, conducted by Roy Goodman. And that ends today's Early Music Show, tracing the history of symphonies. Lucy Skeeping presented, and it was produced in Manchester by Sam Phillips. You can download a podcast version of the programme from the Early Music Show website from next Monday. In tomorrow's programme, Catherine Bott looks at some of the early pioneering composers of the symphony, and that's at the same time, just after 1 o'clock, here on Radio 3. Well, as part of Radio 3's month-long focus on the symphony, the actor Simon Russell Beale will be introducing the first of four programmes exploring music connected to some of the cities he visited while filming the series Symphony for BBC Four. Today's focus is Vienna, with music by Beethoven, Mozart and Schubert. And that's in our Saturday Classics programme, which starts in an hour's time at 3 o'clock. Well, now, a quick look ahead to Friday week on Radio 3 and a special event for all fans of jazz.
As the autumn nights draw in, on Radio 3... the musicians of the London Jazz Festival come out to play. BBC Radio 3 brings you exclusive coverage from one of the world's biggest jazz festivals, starting with an evening of live jazz. Jazz on 3 presents its traditional opening night jazz jamboree. And earlier, Radio 3 gets a front row seat at the festival's spectacular opening night at the Barbican. A 40-piece orchestra and a blend of stellar singing talent. A concert celebrating the jazz voice. The London Jazz Festival on BBC Radio 3.
It's 3 minutes past two now, and time for another chance to hear Monday's lunchtime concert from Wigmore Hall. Here's Sean Rafferty.
Welcome to Wigmore Hall, today transformed into a 17th and 18th century salon with one early 19th century interloper, though there is good reason for that. The music is Italian in flavour, our composers from Naples to Venice, Handel inspired by Italy and sung by a great Venetian. The voice is just one, it's that of Sara Mingardo, one of today's real genuine contraltos, luscious and clear of tone, agile, glowing, full of colour. At the harpsichord, Benjamin Bale, founder and member and conductor of the Saraband Consort, key player in the best period instrument ensembles. Richard Sweeney originally studied cello and guitar, the perfect light and depth, I think, to help his transition to the instrument he plays today, the long-necked lute that is the theorbo. They're performing music by Antonio Lotti, Maestro di Cappello in San Marco, a love song, Pur di Cesti o Bocca Bella. Your beautiful lips have said this sweet word that is yes. Antonio Caldara from an opera pastorale written when he was Maestro di Cappella to the last Duke of Mantua. Se ben crudele, the beloved still loved despite rejection and pain. We have Antonio Vivaldi from his opera Arsilda, Regina di Ponto, Un certo non so che, a seeming attraction to a mere gardener who is, of course, no such thing. I know not what pierces my heart. What if it's love? Benedetto Marcello, renowned for his setting of the Psalms of David, gives in to love too, and the flame that burns. Then The Cuckoo in the Nest, an aria long attributed to Pergolesi, but by Alessandro Parisotti, slipped into his anthology of Italian airs, from which most of today's music comes. It was published at the end of the 19th century. Stravinsky used it in his ballet Pulcinella. If you love me, gentle shepherd, well, fine. You may not, though, be the only one. To begin this recital at Wigmore Hall, two songs by Andrea Falconieri, Bella Porta di Rubini, seeking the dewy pearls of kisses via the ruby gate, and O Bellissimi Capelli, the beautiful dark tresses that shade my lady's face are like the mysterious shadows of night, her eyes like the bright cadence of day. And here to perform them are the Contralto Sara Mingardo, with Benjamin Bale at the harpsichord and Richard Sweeney on the theorbo.
Bella porta di Rubini, Scherzando il viso intorno, notte si.